Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. If Modern Love author Meredith Hall had to point to the year that her life changed, she would probably say that it was 1965. She was 16 that year and pregnant with a son. But more than two decades later, in 1987, her life changed again. And that's the year she writes about in this week's essay. It's read by Marcia Cross. Marcia is best known for her work in ABC's Desperate Housewives. Most recently, she starred in ABC's Quantico and the YouTube Red series Youth and Consequences.
The call came in May. "Hello," the woman said. "My name is Anne Hurd. I work with the New Hampshire courts. I want you to sit down. Your son is looking for you." I had been hoping for this call for 21 years, and it came like a dream into an ordinary spring day. "We will take this very slowly," she said. "This can cause enormous problems for both the child and the birth mother. But I'm ready now. I've been waiting for years. First, you will write letters for a while through me. It is devastating to the child to experience a second abandonment. I could never abandon him again. But it happens a lot," she said. "Where is he?" "I can't tell you that yet." "Can you tell me his name?" I felt myself separate from my voice. "His name," she said, "is Ron." This sound was electric. My son had a name. "Your son," Anne told me, "is extraordinary. Ron is a spectacular young man." 3 weeks later, a letter finally came through Anne. There was a picture enclosed, my first sight of my lost child. It was blurred and gray, but here was Ron. Serious, a strong jaw, intelligent eyes. "Dear Meredith," he wrote, "I don't know what to say. I don't know how to do this. Ron." His handwriting was slanted along the page, hurried. I carried his note in my pocket, reading it again and again as I stared at his photograph. Anne called and said, "Write back to him right away. He's very scared. Ask him some questions." "Dear Ron, my name is Meredith Hall. I live in East Booth Bay on the coast of Maine. I have a son, Morgan, who's 10, and a son named Zachary, who's 7. We keep sheep and chickens and big gardens. Tell me about your family. Tell me about your room. Tell me about what you like to do. I want you to know that I have always loved you." Anne edited our letters for revealing details. They came to us blacked out. "My name is Meredith Blank. I live in Blank on the coast of Blank. My name is Ron Blank. I grew up on a farm in Blank, in southern Blank. My mother and father, Blank and Blank, are very loving and supportive." Our ghost lives slowly took shape. 5 months later, Anne arranged for us to meet. It was 10 a.m. on October 18th. Ron drove slowly along my dirt road. He glanced at me quickly as I stood waiting on the porch steps. I could see blonde hair, curls. He turned off the car, got out, looked at me, and our eyes locked. He was thin, athletic, handsome. My son. He was not a child. He was a young man wearing jeans, a striped sweater, and soft old loafers. He came toward me, crunching on the stone path. His teeth were brilliant white with a space in front. My father had a space like that. I moved toward him. Every day for 21 years I had played this scene. I had never known what to do, and I did not know now. I was breaking with joy and with grief, too, because here he was, a grown man. Here I was, nearly 40. All those years lost forever. I reached for him, held him to me, a stranger, my son, this beautiful, radiant, terrified, smiling son. We did not hold each other long because we were shy, strangers to each other. We walked to the railing of the porch and stood, 3 feet between us, facing the river, looking out over the coast of Maine. I could not find the question that would start our life together. What I wanted to ask was, have you felt my love each day? Have you felt me missing you? Have you known how sorry I am? Have you been loved? Have you been happy? Will you forgive me? All I could come up with was, do you like UNH? Yes. His voice was soft and deep. What year are you? Well, I'm working my way through, so I have another 2 years. His body was taut as if he were ready to fight something off. His face was open, his eyes enormous, blue, set wide apart. He had a scar across his chin. He was very serious. He turned to me and smiled suddenly. He had deep dimples. My brother had those dimples. We smiled, then turned to the ocean again in overwhelmed silence. Do you want to go for a walk? I asked. I felt deep happiness which stirred old sorrow into wild confusion. We walked down the dirt road to the river, blurting out every thought that came, our conversation leaping as we tried to reconstruct the lost years. This is the owl tree, I said. Morgan and Zachary are my sons, your brothers. I saw Ron tense for just a moment and then slip back into the rhythm of our walking. They find owl pellets here, and we dissect them. Ron said, my mother let me play hooky to go fishing with her. My mother. I breathed. Of course, we were two mothers. We sat on an old bench above the undulating seaweed, talking fast. I knew he would drive away that afternoon, and I didn't know if he would ever come again. He must have wondered if I would want him to come again. Sometimes we found ourselves laughing. Twice, Ron said, I've never told anyone this before. We climbed back up the hill and I showed him the downstairs of our homey little cape. Do you want to see your brother's rooms? I asked. Yes, he said quietly. He glanced quickly into their sunny rooms, at their toys and books, at his brother's lives here with me where they've been loved, safe, not given away. We went back down to the kitchen. Eating tuna sandwiches, we returned to our stories. The joy we felt right at that minute, lying like a pond within our grief. Would you like me to tell you about your father? His hand stopped midair. A picture of our first day I will never forget. The image of his powerful hunger to belong. You look like him, I said. He lives in Massachusetts. I was 16, and he was a sophomore at Villanova University. We met at the beach. He came to see me after you were born for 5 or 6 years, showing up, never asking any questions. I watched him struggle to integrate his information into his 21-year-old identity. It doesn't matter anyway, was all he could say. He let me hug him goodbye at his car. He called on Wednesday and said he was coming on Sunday. Can the boys be there? He asked. I was overcome by his courage. It was the beginning of our new family. I ached with guilt about my two young sons, understanding that I was asking them to take in stride the effects of my own enormous history. They never balked. When I told them they had a big brother, they immediately embraced him. They stood in front of Ron at that first meeting and grinned. They climbed on him, giggling. Like monkeys, they studied every inch of him, probing and touching, pulling off his socks and shoes, studying his toes and hands and back, comparing their own. They peered inside his mouth. Morgan draped his arm over his shoulder while they sat on the couch. Zachary got in under Ron's arm. Ron came every Sunday, then for weekends, and then for the summer. I was stunned by my son's capacity to include Ron, to give him part of me. And Ron took me to his family, too. "This is my mother, Rose," he said. "This is my other mother, Meredith." He did not call me Mom or Mum or Mama like Morgan and Zachary. He had a mother. He had a sister, Tammy, adopted when she was 2. He had a father, Hank. Astonishingly, Rose and Hank welcomed me as if they were happy I had come into Ron's life. I felt as if I had stolen their son. Those months were confusing, upheaving, yet laughter often filled the house, and we cried. We rested in our deep love for each other, and then we would fly apart in hurt or despair. Some days we needed to be reassured that this was forever. Other days, we fought for our lives, the lives that had worked pretty well before. Sometimes we couldn't contain everything that had been lost. I had never told my friends about this child. The grief and shame of losing him at 16 had stayed with me all my life as a fiercely private sorrow. Now they argued with me, telling me that Morgan and Zachary should not have to pay the price of my history. "Are you telling me I should send this child away again?" I asked. "Yes," they said. "This isn't fair to your children." But an older friend disagreed, telling me, "This is your son. Don't listen to them. This is a miracle. It is a fairy tale with a happy ending." Then it was October 18th again, our first anniversary. Our days had found rhythm. The upheaving emotions were quieting. My friend was right. This was a miracle. Though each day felt fragile, as if it all might disappear if we turned our backs. Still, our old lives receded and our new family held together. I had my son, he had his mother. To mark the day, I gave him my small clay owl, the only thing I had from those devastated years after he was born. "This is to remind you every day that this place in my life is forever," I said. And he gave me an acorn. "My renaissance," he said, his voice soft and hopeful. There were no patterns for how to do this, how to hold each other safely and fully after a lifetime apart. We could not plot out the future. We were a family. We loved each other. We needed each other. That was our only map.
Marcia Cross, reading Meredith Hall's essay, "I Placed My Son for Adoption at 16. Could We Try Again?" We'll hear more from Meredith right after this.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Meredith Hall's essay was published 14 years ago, but the meeting she writes about happened long before that, in 1987. Ron is 53 now, and Meredith is 70, but she still vividly remembers her pregnancy.
I got pregnant in 1965. My family kicked me out. My public school not only kicked me out, but wrote in my record that I was expelled for pregnancy and not allowed to attend another public school in the state because of that. People think that it was, it was the 60s. It was not the 60s in Hampton, New Hampshire. There was a set of values and expectations that were exceedingly tight and strict and very judgmental. My mother was a single mother, and I think that she just could not tolerate having me be in the town, visible, shaming her every day. And she told me I had to get out.
Meredith's parents were divorced. Her father agreed to take her in.
When my father came over to the house that afternoon, he turned to me and asked me who the father was. And then he asked if I wanted to marry him. I was 16 and horrified at the idea and said no. He turned to my mother and said, "Well, now what?" And that's when she said, "Well, she can't live here." And somehow between the two of them, with me not being any part of the conversation at all, it was decided that the child would be given up for adoption. I don't imagine that there was any debate about that at all. Of course, over the years, I wished that I had been able to fight against that tidal wave of shame and had said something about, can't we keep this child? Isn't there a way to keep this child? But my family was not a family that was built to do that.
Meredith says her family was determined to keep her pregnancy secret.
My father he let me live there for the last 4 months of my pregnancy, but he hid me in the upstairs and I was not allowed to be outside at all. None of their friends knew that I was even there in the house.
After Ron was born, Meredith wasn't allowed to see him in the hospital. Not long after, she was sent to boarding school.
The headmistress agreed to take me, providing I never said a word for that senior year to anybody about this child. I was bound to complete silence with not a single person saying to me, "Oh, you had a child and lost this child."
But Meredith loved school, and she did well there. Her mother picked her up after graduation, expecting Meredith to move back home.
And instead, I never unpacked my suitcase. I told her that I was leaving, and I walked out and took a bus to Boston, not knowing a soul in Boston, and eventually figured out a way to get a job and an apartment, and that was it. I was off on my new life.
Meredith worked at a restaurant and a copy store while she was living in Massachusetts. She also started dating a Harvard student. She says that they planned to travel together. They were supposed to meet in Europe before hitchhiking across India. But right after her plane landed in Luxembourg, Meredith changed her mind about that trip.
I don't know what happened. I untethered and I sent a telegram to him at American Express saying that I was going to go off on my own. I had very little money with me, and I very, very recklessly hitchhiked through Europe, selling the things in my backpack piece by piece, and headed farther and farther east. I spent some time in Greece and in Turkey, and ended up mostly in Syria and Lebanon, and spent most of a year there. By then, everything was gone. I had sold everything. I periodically sold blood. I'd get $3 for my blood, and it would buy a visa, and I just wandered. I have a friend who looks back on all this and says this was my suicide walk, and I don't think that that's inaccurate. I was so filled with grief. By then, my father had also kicked me out of his life, or his wife did, and he didn't fight it over a very trivial event. And having lost my mother and my father, and losing this baby and losing my community, I think that at that point I just felt that I had absolutely nothing else to lose, and that nothing that happened could be worse than what already had happened.
After a year, Meredith left the Middle East and hitchhiked back through Europe.
I had asked my mother to provide funds for a plane ticket home, and her reply was, "You made your bed, you rest in it." So I did beg money on the streets of Geneva, and I managed to make enough money to fly back to New York and then Boston, and just picked up there. I lived in Gloucester for a while and met a young man there, and we fell in love. He wanted to build boats on the coast of Maine, and I started living on the coast of Maine then. I was very happy to be married to this man. I felt loved by him. And the brunt of that sorrow and loss softens over time. It always does. And when I got pregnant with my first child, with my husband, I felt a joy that was unimaginable to me. And we were a little island of extreme happiness and joy during those early years.
During those same years, Ron was living one state away, growing up in southern New Hampshire. His adoptive parents were supportive and generous when Ron, at 21, wanted to form a relationship with Meredith. But she says things hadn't always been that way.
They lived on a very poor farm in New Hampshire. Ron was worked very hard from the time he was a small child. And his mother was very fragile emotionally and could not protect herself and could not protect her children. So it was a very, very dark and difficult childhood for my son. And somehow, extraordinarily, he maintained that person that he is, just a very, very tender and kind person.
After they were introduced, Meredith's relationship with Ron continued to grow.
He really joined the family. He eventually moved to Maine, and I found a piece of land, and we built a house for my younger sons and me. And then Ron actually bought adjacent land and built a house there, so we became neighbors. And although it was challenging to figure out the emotional landscape, how do we transcend the pain and the hurt and the questions that an adopted child always feels about why he or she was given up for adoption? But somehow I think the depth of love was very profound, and I think we worked very, very hard. And we managed to build a relationship that has been sustained till now.
Ron and another of Meredith's sons live in California now. Her third son lives in Texas. She says they are all very close and see each other frequently. Meredith's parents have both passed away. She says that they never seem to regret their actions toward her. She's worked to come to terms with that, but she doesn't call it forgiveness.
For me, the problem with forgiveness is that it seems to be predicated on one person who was harmed and another person who did harm. And somehow, out of the great goodness of heart, that victim bestows some kind of forgiveness on the person who did the harm. I really don't like the imbalance of that. It feels false, and that's very uncomfortable for me. I think there's something more akin to acceptance that is what I've worked hard at. I actually believe that the difficulties I faced when I was young with both my mother's and my father's outcastings, as devastating as those outcastings were, I think somehow they have increased my capacity to love and increased my capacity to feel empathy and compassion for other people.
That's Meredith Hall. She's a writer living in Cape Elizabeth, Maine. Her memoir is called Without a Map, and she's recently completed a new novel. More after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Here's Marcia Cross on why she connected with Meredith's story.
At first, it was just instinct that drew me to it, and I think it's because I had an emotional response to it. But after reading it and sitting with it for so long, I think it was just the courage of both of these two humans to come together after makes me cry. Such a painful journey for both of them. One to, you know, they both suffered a great loss. So I guess it was just human beings at their most loving, most generous. It's easier to back away. And they went through it. And I think that is, those are our heroes in life.
Thanks again to Marcia for reading this week's essay. Her projects include Desperate Housewives, Melrose Place, and Quantico. And here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I've rarely come across a piece that just has so much sort of going on beneath the surface, and all these years of loss combined with this sort of yearning for the future, or yearning to reconnect and hoping that it happens, but also the fears of how it can go wrong. Just that sort of twist of hope and fear and love and connection. It's just so hard to sort of tease that out, and the way that she writes about it, using basic words, simple description, simple dialogue, and the thing is just like bursting at the seams with meaning and heartbreak and the sort of love of reunification.
Next week, Logan Browning.
I stumbled across Justin's online dating profile while waiting for water to boil. I had just gotten home from running errands, ATM, mailbox, grocery store, and was cooking dinner before sitting down to work. It was just after 4 a.m. Message me if you want to talk about anything and everything until the wee hours of the night, his profile said. The phrase wee hours, as it turns out, means different things to different people. For him, a software engineer with an eye for design who can wail on an electric guitar, the wee hours are 2 a.m., maybe 3. For me, it's a little more complicated.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Our intern is Shemi Aloko. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at The New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music courtesy of APM. And if you love the podcast, rate or review us on Apple Podcasts or tell a friend to listen. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.